It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta Mercedes-Benz Sandy Springs.
Well, good morning and welcome to Money Matters. Spring is in the air. The top three things you need to know here today on Money Matters. Thank you for tuning in. Number one, economists are awful at predicting recessions. Number one. Number two, the housing market. I want to give us a housing market update comparing hot cities to cold cities. Where are we in the housing cycle? And is the housing market still okay? Number three, dividend paying stocks. How do they outdo the S&P 500? All this today here on Money Matters. We might have time for an economic update. Happy retirement, you name it. We're here live on a Sunday morning. So thank you for joining us. Ryan Ealy here, standing by to take your calls and your questions. Wes Moss here, your host, every Sunday morning, 9 until 11 a.m. to take your calls and your questions here on the show. S&P 500 off to its best start since 1998. What's happening? So for the week, we had the Dow up about 1.7%. S&P 500 about 1.2%. That's on the week. But big deal, forget the week. How have we done so far in 2019? Remember, we dropped 20% to close out 2018. And just ended on a very sour note in markets. People running for the hills, selling stocks indiscriminately, almost full capitulation as we wound up into the Christmas Eve. And then it's really been a rebound almost ever since. Rebound for stocks, oversold conditions at the end of 2018, and arguably the market's almost been too good in 2019. Well, why? The market has its eye on two very major things. We talk about this at the beginning of the year. If these two things get solved, then you're going to see better equity markets. That was the Fed. Check that box. Two, China still waiting to put a check in that box. As of the end of 2018, it looked like the Fed was going to crank up interest rates with a blind eye to seeing what the economy was doing into oblivion. That stopped in January. Jerome Powell came out and said, look, we're done. We're done likely for the rest of the year. We're not creating enough inflation. By the way, we had a CPI number this past week, up 1.8%. We are back in Goldilocks land. Again, that means inflation, the economy, economic numbers, good, not great. Not hot, not cold, somewhere right in the middle, just like the Fed wants it and just like investors want it. And that's exactly what's happened so far this year. So where are we this year? For the Dow Jones, up 11% in 2019. It would be higher than that if we didn't have what's happening with Boeing, obviously. That stock down because of what's happened with its two airline crashes. The S&P 500 for the year, up 13%. NASDAQ up even more than that at 16% just so far for 2019. Put that all together. And almost getting a China deal or getting some sort of, we have optimism that we're going to get a deal done, even if it happens as late as this summer. Markets think something's going to happen. If you talk to Washington insiders, same thing. It looks as though there's a willingness to do a deal on the part of President Trump. All that you put all that together in a big bowl of soup, and it's a good one. Best start for stocks since 1998. Best first quarter. So, good morning. Welcome to Money Matters here. The phone lines are open to take your calls and questions here on this Sunday morning, which is the most fun part about what we do here. I know it's early to talk about money, stocks, finance, mortgages, you name it, but we're here. And this is the most fun thing we do all week. So, good morning and join us. Thank you for joining us. And feel free to give us a call here in the studio. So, if you have questions about maybe it's an IRA question, a Roth question, a pension question, if you're wondering, should you be taking a lump sum versus an annuity payment that lasts you the rest of your life? Does it cover your life? Does it cover your spouse's life? Are you thinking about paying off a mortgage? Is it the right time to do that? What do we do with stocks here now getting back closer to the all-time high we saw at the beginning of September in 2018? Or not. So we're happy to weigh in on those decisions and just maybe give you an objective third opinion to help you make the decision or set you in the right direction to make sure you're not messing something up, making sure that you're not making a major mistake. That's what we love to do here on the show here on Sunday mornings. The phone lines open. The number 404-872-0750. I for some reason, I always write the number down. Why say the number? I don't know what that is. 404-872-0750 is the number here in the studio. Ryan Ely standing by to take your calls, and we will talk this morning. Also, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Again, 1-800-972-8255 here on a Sunday morning. Let's first start with this. I was driving the car yesterday. My in-laws are in town. My sister's in town. My sister from Philadelphia is in town. And her fiance or her husband. My brother is in town he lives in Los Angeles. Works at UCLA. UCLA hospitals. He and his fiance were here. And we're just always, of course, we're talking about hey, how's the world going? This is a kid who... the doctor track in America is so long and so arduous. He had his 34th birthday just this week and just started to really make a living after 4 years of medical school, 5 years of residency, another year of fellowship, now finally back in California for starting to make a living. The question goes, hey, we're going to buy a house. Should we buy a house? Is the economy about to roll over? When do you think we're going to go into recession? Does it look like a recession is on the horizon? Well, the answer here is that it's just hard to tell. In fact, there's some data that shows just how bad economists are at forecasting recessions. Now, I'm not trying to pour cold water on what I do for a living. Am I an economist? Sure. I have an economics degree from the University of North Carolina. It is the backbone of my education, how I think about the world. But as far as finding and predicting when you're going to see an economic downturn, we can look at the finest, best economists on the planet. We can look at the hundreds of economists that are at the International Monetary Fund. And let's do some data here about how good they are at predicting recessions. So think of first of all, the job of an economist. If this is all you're doing, is trying to say, are we going to grow, stay flat, or go down? That is the job of an economist, if you will. Think about all the economic data points. And you think back to math, you think about combinations. When you have 5 data points, then you have 10 data points. Think about NCAA basketball, where we are today, 64 teams. The combination of just those 64 teams is not infinite, but it is a very massive number. And if you think about the reason that Warren Buffett gives away $1 billion, if you get, and Ryan, I'm going to let you give me the probability. What are the different probabilities on 64 different teams? The reason Warren Buffett gives away $1 billion if you get that bracket perfect is that it is virtually impossible to do. And that is because you have 64 different variables that can go, I guess the math is 64 to the 64th power. I don't know what the math is. Ryan's going to give it to me in a minute. But think of that now and think of that as economic data points. So there are millions, literally billions of combinations because you have any given data point. And there are hundreds, not 64 teams anymore. We're talking about hundreds of economic data points. And they can come in, they can come in strong. They can come in good, bad, lukewarm. They can come in a very short burst of time. They can come over a long period of time. It can be a blip. You could get an exogenous shock from a storm or an election, or that's something that could be long-lasting, short-lasting, data that's in arrears or in the rearview mirror, coincident data that's happening right now. Oh, here we go. What's the math on this, Ryan? 1 in 92 quintillion. 1 in 92 quintillion, which is just that. Here we go. I don't know. I don't even know how many zeros that is. And that's only for 64 different data points, if you think about teams as data points. So economic data is virtually to infinity the number of combinations that can happen. Coincident data, forward-looking data. Then you put in human emotion and how we see or how you see the economy, which is another fascinating way to look at this. So we have our own biases. We have our own bias. So the inputs are in the hundreds, and the outputs are nearly infinite for the outcomes. For example, let me talk about human emotion for a second and how it colors how we see the economy. Today, if you're a Republican, you see this as a wonderful economy right now. If you're listening to me and you're a Republican, you're saying, you know what? Yeah, economy's pretty good right now. If you're a Democrat, though, you feel very differently. It is fascinating to chart the two parties. You can look at the consumer comfort or consumer sentiment measures, and you can chart this between the two parties. If you look at the blue line representing sentiment levels for Democrats, it's right where it's been since 2014, right around the same levels as 2014. And it tracked very closely to the red line or the Republican line. Since the end of 2016, so call it 2017 and beyond, the Republican economic sentiment has skyrocketed relative to the blue line. Same economy. Now, you could argue the point it's not the same economy that we had in 2017, and we all are in our own personal economies. But listen, same economy, same America, completely different outlooks on how it's going, showing up in economic numbers or economic data points. You look at the graph, there's this massive divergence. Republicans right now think the economy is great. Democrats do not. And we're living in the same country at the same time in the same America. Our own feelings and our own emotions color how we feel or perceive what's happening. Talk about a tough job. We're going to talk about the data points on out of how many recessions that have happened over the last 20 some years, how many were predicted correctly the spring before the year it happened. So call it a year and a half out. We're going to get to that data when Money Matters returns straight ahead. So math alert here on Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. When we're talking about the quintillion variety, 1 in 9.2 quintillion is getting all of your NCAA brackets perfectly correct. So mine are already blown. UNC lost. I'm out. Another frustrating year of tournament. But just think about that math. 64 different initial inputs. The variety of outcomes, effectively 99.2 quintillion. Quintillion is 18 zeros. Quintillion is 18 zeros. So think about how difficult it is to forecast some sort of economic downturn with as many variables as there are there. Here's the data on this. For the economy, so think about it. For stocks, there's a plethora of doomsday advice. Market's about to fall, about to crack, about to crash. You hear that every day. Tremendous, tremendous amounts of missed warnings over and over and over. The market's going to fall, and said stocks do well. We've seen that hundreds and hundreds of times just in the past 10 years. For the economy, though, it's almost the inverse. Very few recessions have been well forecast. This is from Bloomberg, a London-based economist study that Andrew Bridgen, from the chief economist at Fathom Consulting, studied 469 economic downturns since 1998. So think about this, effectively looking at recessions per country around the world since 1998. So individual countries that go into recession around the world. The IMF predicted how many of the 469 recessions since 1998 in all these different countries, how many were predicted the spring of the year before it happened. The answer is 4. 4 out of 469 recessions were predicted the spring prior to that recession, or the let's call it this spring, and then you go into recession the next year. So 4 out of 469, that's a 99% miss rate. The IMF is a pretty smart group. We've got over 150 countries, 189 member countries. You have staff from 150 countries, 2,700 folks work there. Many of those are economists, and they have a less than a 1% correct rate. Once a recession was right around the corner, so now we're in the spring of the year which the recession occurred, how many did they get right there? 111 out of 469. So that's a correct rate of only 24%. Unbelievably difficult. Recessions are almost like bad weather. They're almost like a tornado. They're always kind of floating around. We're always on recession or tornado watch. If conditions are right, it can spin up quickly. That's why it's so hard to forecast it a long way out. More money. Well, good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. So we know economists have a tough job. It's very difficult to see with a whole lot of certainty when we're going to go into a recession because the data points are infinite. Hundreds of data points that can come in any given way. You put those together, the chances of getting it, nailing it perfectly are one in, let's call it the quintillions. Call it a big number with 18 zeros. And that's why the International Monetary Fund has a really tough time forecasting recessions. Again, out of 469 recessions around the globe, how many did they get right the spring before the year it happened? The answer is four. Four out of 469, that's a 99.15% miss rate. How about in the year in which recessions occurred? So let's say recessions in the fall. How often did they get it right the spring preceding that recession? The answer, 111 times out of 469. So they had a 24% correct rate in the year it happened. So it's tough. So what do we do about this? And here's the other thing you hear all the time about what's going to happen with the economy. And this all kind of spurred as I had family in town in different professions in the medical field. Hey, what's going to happen in the world? Are we about to go into recession? The answer is, well, International Monetary Fund can't even tell you if it's going to happen in the same year it's going to happen. So predicting, but yet you'll hear these predictions over and over again. Well, I'm predicting a contraction in the next 18 to 24 months. The reason that that's kind of, it's almost like saying, I predicted the sun will rise tomorrow. So when you hear this, there's a reasonable chance you're going to get a recession at some point. Since 1959, the chance that the U.S. economy will be in a recession any given month, it's about 13%. So in any given month, we have a good shot at recession. Well, what can we do about it? I want to go to the phones here in a minute. Oh, okay. We had a bunch of callers here, and now I guess it's time to call in again. So I know sometimes you get a hold here just for a little bit until I shut my mouth, but we'll open up the phone lines, and I will take calls now this block here. So call us in the studio, 404-872-0750. Again, as I write this number down, 404-872-0750, your calls, questions, whether it relates to an annuity question or a stock or ETF or a fund question or an investment tax question or some sort of mortgage question or a pension versus a lump sum. Are you thinking about going in one of these two directions? Maybe it's just a fork in the road. We're here to give you some objective advice and try to help you make a more informed decision. That's what we do here on Sunday mornings. It's the most fun part about our job here on Money Matters. So we're happy to do it. Ryan Ely here standing by to take your calls and questions, patch those through, and we'll figure some things out together here on the Sunday morning. The number again, 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK, 1-800-972-0750. 8255. Well, what can we do about this? What can we do about this lack of the ability to know when we're going to go into recession? Let's recognize, number one, what can we do? Number one, recognize that it's nearly impossible to dance between every raindrop and know when the rain's coming or when the tornado or the dust storm will whip up. You and I, we both know we've got to invest in good times and bad economic times. That's part of the job. Good and bad stock markets, that's part of the job. You only need one more good economic cycle to get through a rough patch. Things can be bad, they can be bad, they can be bad, bad economy, bad stock market, bad job economy. If you survive that, when things recover, you're glad you did. Number two, be mindful of your economy. Right, the big picture economy obviously matters, but you can't ignore how it impacts your particular neck of the woods. You don't want to go out and make a bad business deal or big real estate purchase that's ultra risky right before a big economic downturn. So understand how the economy is impacting you and your livelihood and your profession and your industry at any given time. How the economics are changing for medicine, or if you're in software, or if you're in banking, or if you're in real estate. How will that impact your earnings in the future of your work? Which again, your earnings and your earning potential, potentially one of the most overlooked places when it comes to financial and investment planning. Nobody ever talks about, hey, what are the decisions you're making to increase your income and your revenue over time? And then three, of course, stay the course. Markets will be wonderful like they've been this year so far. Up 13% on the S&P 500, up 11% on the Dow. The NASDAQ's up 16% just in 2019. That's awesome. It's wonderful. Markets will be that way. They will be wonderful, but they'll also be awful. And that is the game that we are in. It's a feast or famine scenario. We've just recently come off a wonderful feast for stocks. It's been great. But we know that we go through periods of time when it's the exact opposite of what we've just lived. And the sooner you accept that, the easier the roller coaster ride will be. Now, as we transition, there was kind of a big IPO this week. I just remember there was a time, many, many, many years in the investment business when I remember IPOs just kind of came all the time. Oh, another IPO, another IPO. And then we have had just this tiny, tiny trickle of IPOs over the last several years. And this is the year that it looks as though the levee is breaking. And this isn't necessarily a bad thing, but all these pent-up IPOs that haven't gone public and haven't gone public and haven't gone public, it's really happening this year. And I think the first one that cracks through this dam was Lyft this week. So $20 billion valuation, the founder. So Logan Green, he's the company CEO. He has, so it's Logan Green and then John Zimmer. How much did these guys make? And this is just what's just fascinating about taking companies public. And even though they have just a fraction of a percent of these companies, you get a $20 billion valuation, you're gonna make some serious money. So Logan Green, the company's CEO, walked away after Friday's trading, call it around set with a $700 million net worth. So that's the stock, then his restricted stock units. The president, John Zimmer, also including RSUs, just a slightly smaller bounty, if you will, and an estimated walked away at over $600 million on Friday. So really, if you look at after the stock traded, $800 million for Logan Green and $600 million for John Zimmer. Just amazing. How about the stats behind Lyft? Obviously, it's kind of number two, right behind Uber. It's kind of changed the way, it's changed transportation in America for us. Lyft gave almost 19 million people a ride in the fourth quarter of 2018. 18.6 million people used Lyft in the fourth quarter, up from in 2016, they were running at about a 6.5 million ride rate per quarter. It also has a 39% share of the U.S. ride-hailing market, up from only 22% in 2016. So, and this is a company that still doesn't even make any money. Still doesn't even make any money. So they took, as far this last year, Lyft lost $911 million. So over the last year, they've lost almost $1 billion. And that's up from their losses the year before that were a little less than $700 million. But now they are public. Now this is a $20 billion valuation. The public owns the stock now. Thousands and thousands of people bought that stock on Friday or received that stock. And then that stock became, they had a value and started trading in the open marketplace on Friday. And it's created just massive, massive wealth. And we're gonna see more of that. We're gonna see more and more of that as the levy is now broken in a good way, as we see a flood of IPOs here in the year 2019. Of course, you know, Uber is likely going public this year, Slack going public, Pinterest going public, Postmates going public, Palantir, Airbnb, Peloton, the spin bike app. And machine company, exercise equipment company, likely going public this year. And 2019 might be the biggest year on record by dollars raised. Well, we're $20 billion on the way to doing that. So good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. So much happening this week. Again, if you've just been tuning in, the top three things you need to know here on a Sunday morning. Number one, economists are awful at predicting recessions. We talked about that. They get about four in 469, right? It's about a 0.85% correct rate, so a little less than 1% accuracy. Looked at another way, a 99% inaccuracy rate on predicting recessions a year and a half out. Number two, the housing market's still okay, and we're going to compare hot and cold cities in the United States. And then take a hard look at dividend-paying stocks and how they fare against the S&P 500. So I'm always fascinated again with real estate and what the housing market's doing. And we have to take a look. I want to take a good look at what's happening here in the world of arguably your largest asset. So for most Americans, if you own a home, it becomes your largest asset, potentially that, and then your 401k. Where are we in this cycle, though? Because it drives so much of the sentiment in America, so much of how we feel about our own net worth and our own economy. How's my house doing? How's my real estate doing? Well, if you really take a look at charts, and I went back to 1987 and looked at housing data, housing prices, mortgage applications, housing starts, all this, again, multiple variables of economic data that relate back to housing, to see, you know, where are we in this cycle? If I asked you this question, where are we relative today, relative to the peak right before the bottom dropped out in 2007? How have things gone since the bubble effectively burst for housing and then led to the largest recession, the deepest recession we've seen since the Great Depression? Where are we in that? We know that housing prices fell a full third, so 28% for the national composite, which includes, let's call it 100 some cities. If you look at the 20 city index, which is obviously the largest 20 metros, and then the 10 city index, those were worse because they're obviously more weighted towards these bigger, what were even more bubbly markets. Down 35%, the 20 city index, and then the 10 city index down over 35% from peak to trough. Now, where do we stand today? Have we climbed back? Are we back to where we were? Are we back above it? Well, the answer lies in the different cities that we can go through. So let's do this really on a city-by-city basis. We'll talk about some of the cities that are hot, some of the cities that are still cold and haven't really made it back. All here on Money Matters. So good morning. Welcome to the show. We're going to run to a quick weather, traffic. Then we're going to come back, talk housing market, hot cities, cold cities right here. Housing. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. As of 2019, home prices, where do they stand? Where are we relative to the big crash we saw at the start of 2007? As of 2019, housing prices nationwide, only 10.9%, let's just call it 11% above pre-crisis levels. 11% above pre-crisis levels. So we peaked out in 2007 and then cratered for, call it all the way until, call it right around 2012. That's when prices bottomed. We cratered 35% on the 20 city index, the 10 city index, and then nationally we cratered 27%. And then it's taken many years just to get back to even. And it's really only been since, call it, late 2016, early 2017. So not long ago did the national index go back above where we were. And then we've made some small gains. So let's talk about how has housing done since 2000. If we go back to 2000s, that's kind of the start of the housing boom, really the housing, kind of the start of the housing bubble, if you will. National home prices rose about 3.7% per year. Now, if you look at this all the way since 2000, inflation during that same period of time ran about 2.2%. So housing climbed about, call it 2%, not quite, well, let's call it 1.5% above inflation. So, and I want you to think about this. When we talk about housing, we think that, and we know we have these periods of time where we can buy in an area that gets gentrified and it gets really good, or we buy in 2008 or 9 at the bottom, or let's call it we buy in 2010, the bottom of the cycle, and things recover. We think that we can make these big gains in housing and real estate, and we can. But for the most part, housing as an asset relative to stocks, you're getting, and this is going back, this is 18 years of data from the year 2000 in America all the way till the end of last year. If we go back to 2000, housing has gained 3.7%. Inflation has been 2.2%. So we are positive. Housing has been about a 1.5% rate of return better than inflation. That's it. Not much more than inflation. Look at housing starts. I think this is one of my favorite charts on housing starts. As you can tell the activity, and you could really tell how bubbly things got as we went into the year 2007. We were at about 2.2 million housing starts. That means builders were breaking ground on, you know, get over 2 million new units in any given year. That was the annual pace. And then when we hit the crisis, or we hit the Great Recession, housing activity didn't just slow down. It hit a brick wall and it virtually stopped. We went from 2.2 million housing starts to about 400,000. Now think about it, that's 75%. It's a crater in an entire industry. And then it has slowly come back steadily over the last, call it, decade. Where are we today? About 1.2 million housing starts, kind of around equilibrium. You are listening to Money Matters. We're talking housing, what economists can tell you about recessions, and then we'll talk about dividend-paying stocks. And then your phone calls in the 10 o'clock hour. We'll take your phone calls, your questions. Happy to do it. More Money Matters in the 10 o'clock hour straight ahead.
WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. Ryan Ely and I just talking about the George Strait concert last night. If Mercedes-Benz Stadium is so nice. It's so beautiful. It's so immaculate. And to think about, I'm just looking at some of these pictures. I kept taking photographs. We were down on the floor, which is this massive floor area that they open up. And it's about 2/3 of the stadium is opened up for tickets. So you've got the stage kind of on one end, and then the whole place, 2/3, 3/4 of the place is open. every single seat packed, every single seat filled. And just, I can't imagine this guy, George Strait, just looking out and having probably 35, 40,000 people just screaming and yelling to this man with just a gifted voice. He was gifted a golden voice. He doesn't even need to play the guitar. He's up there and he's just the king, really. Oh, there you go. A little George Strait in the background. Yeah, just magical. I could have stayed for five times as much the time he played. He probably played for 2 hours. Could have listened to it for 10. Anyway, we're here on a Sunday morning, and we're talking about everything from housing to economists to dividend-paying stocks, and we just talked about the housing market broadly. I'm going to go over some of the cities that are there are a handful of cities that are still below the 2007 peak. So if you look at some of the big metro areas, housing's still behind in some of these areas, still below the pre-crisis peak. What are those cities? And then you've got other cities that have done phenomenally well and are way above the peak. And we'll go through some of those cities. The number here in the studio, I want to go to the phones though. So phone lines open here on this chilly Sunday morning. And if you are headed to church or going to maybe get in a round of golf or doing something fun with your family or brunch, then we're here as well. So it's 10 o'clock hour Money Matters where we want to go to the phones. So phone lines open. Give us a call here in the studio. What are you going to call about? Well, anything that's been on your mind, whether it has to do with an IRA or a 401k and maybe accessing money early. Hey, I'm thinking about retiring, but I'm not even 59 and a half. What should I do? How do I access the money without paying a penalty? If you're an early retiree, there's a lot of different strategies that are important to really think about. What are you going to do for healthcare if you retire before 65? What if your company or your employer doesn't give you coverage between 62 and 65 and you're retired? How do you get it? What does that look like? Is there a strategy where you can keep your income low and have your healthcare a lot cheaper through the exchange? That's a possibility. Whether maybe it's an investment question that has to do with a mutual fund or an annuity, and you're worried, should you get out of this? Should you dump this? Should you keep this? Or maybe it's just a dividend-paying stock question. How do I generate more income in one of the six asset classes, whether it be bonds, stocks, preferreds, MLPs, or income commodities, REITs, closed-end funds, you name it. What one of these areas should I be looking at to generate better income or higher income now that I'm closer to retirement? All these questions swirling around your head. Hey, should I pay off my mortgage? Does that make sense? At what level? When do I do that? All questions that we will tackle with you and try to just give you our third-party objective opinion here on a Sunday morning. It's the fun part of Money Matters. So give us a call here in the studio. The number 404-872-0750. Again, the number 404-872-0750 is the number in the studio, or 1-800-WSB-TALK. Or really, it could be a pension versus lump sum. There's a ton of complexity that goes into you figuring out what's a good deal. Do I take a big lump sum of money or I take a monthly pension? And then I have all these different options on the different pensions that I can take. Which ones make sense? How do you make the best, most rational call on that for your overall financial plan and your family? And we're here to help you with that equation, set you on the right path so you're making the best money moves and just avoiding big money mistakes. That's what we'll do here on a Sunday morning. So give us a call in the studio. Phone lines open, 404-872-0750. Again, 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK is the toll-free number if you're outside of Georgia. 1-800-972-8255. And we will go to the phones here in just a couple of minutes. Now, I do want to get back to and finish up housing. Housing is just this hugely important, almost center of the economic universe here in the United States. We know that we had this bubble that was created from 2000 all the way to 2007. Then prices crashed down 30%. Most of those have recovered. Well, let's start with our hometown, Atlanta. Where are we today relative to the peak before we dropped right in 2007? The answer, 9% above the pre-crisis peak. which makes a lot of sense. I've done, we've done a lot of research over the years on Atlanta housing prices. And Atlanta, for a variety of reasons, ends up being kind of right there. It's very representative. It's representative of the nation. It's kind of, as the nation average goes, so does Atlanta in a lot of ways. Part of that is that we didn't get quite as bubbly because you can build out and we don't have geographic barriers. So we're not bound by water like Manhattan. We're not bound by water, at least on one side, like San Francisco. So we never got, of course, housing prices here were in a bubble, just like they were around the country, but it didn't get as crazy and as overinflated as some other markets. It makes sense now that the national Case-Shiller home price index is about 11% above its peak. Atlanta's 9% above its pre-crisis peak. So very, very in line with what the rest of the nation has done. Now, here's some outliers. Denver and Dallas. Denver, since the peak, or relative to the 2007 peak, up 54%. So Denver real estate has done phenomenally well. The nation up 11, Denver up 54% above the pre-crisis peak, and then Dallas up 49% since the pre-crisis peak. Now, there are a couple outliers in the other direction. Phoenix, Tampa, New York. Housing prices still 18%, 10%, and 6% below their pre-crisis peak. So Phoenix is down 18% still. New York City down 10% since the pre-crisis peak, so still hasn't recovered fully. And then 6% for, 10% for Tampa, and then 6% New York City below its pre-crisis peak. So all three, though, if you look longer term, still up significantly since the year 2000. Since the year 2000, Phoenix is up 87%. Tampa is up 114%. And New York, as in New York City, up 102% since the year 2000. So where are we in this cycle? It looks to me as though we're still in the middle of the housing cycle, the middle of this multi-year slow, steady expansion. So we know that if you look at just very recent data, we see that New York City, Honolulu, Austin, we've actually started to see some price reductions, and we've seen this, and that's part of the reason they're not back above their pre-crisis peak. But as of last summer, only three out of 100 of the largest housing markets, only three have seen prices actually decline. A lot of what we see, and you hear these housing numbers, has to do with slower growth, but not actually going in the wrong direction. Only three cities out of 100 are moving in the wrong direction. So we've had a big part of this too. If you look at where mortgage levels are, and I charted out mortgage levels, because interest rates have dropped recently, just this really in the last couple of months, because the Fed's kind of said we're on hold, the average mortgage rates, which top were in the 5% range. So if you look at the average U.S. 30-year mortgage rate, a couple months ago, that was back above 5%. Today, it's at 4.06%. So with a drop in interest rates, we've seen this massive drop in the cost to borrow for housing. What is that going to do? It's probably a good thing for housing and housing prices over the next several months and years. We're going to go to the phones here. We're going to start with, where are we going, Ryan? We're going to two. We're going to Clyde in Jefferson. Clyde, good morning. Welcome to the show. How can I help?
Oh, yes, Wes. I've been meaning to call you for a while about this one. I appreciate what you do. I'm a 59 and a half, thinking about maybe a slightly early retirement. I've got about 10% of my portfolio in balanced funds, the majority in Wellington. As I'm looking forward, though, you know, with a balanced fund like that, you can't sell the stocks when they're high and you can't sell the bonds when they're high. I was thinking of splitting it up. What do you think about selling that and going into independent bond and independent stock funds?
So Clyde, let me get a little more clarity here. So 10% in balanced funds, or you have every 90% in balanced funds?
No, 10% in balanced funds.
What's the rest of it in?
About a 70-30 split, the various things. I'm a student of you and you know, the American Association of Independent Investors. So I'm pretty well diversified, but fairly aggressive.
So if you think about Wellington right now, Wellington is one of the it's been a wonderful fund, by the way. And what Clyde's talking about, Vanguard Wellington, which is one of their actively managed funds. It's not an index strategy like a lot of their funds, but it's an active strategy, and it has about 65% exposure to stocks. The other 35% is bonds. The answer here is that I'm still okay with using these balanced funds, but your question about do you diversify out and do the bonds separate than the stocks, I think the answer is maybe, but we've got to run to a quick break. So Clyde, hang on one second here. I'm going to answer your call when we run to a quick news weather, and we'll be back with Money Matters and an answer for Clyde and his balanced funds when Money Matters returns. And we're back live. Welcome back to Money Matters. So we're going to have George Strait playing for the rest of the day. As we go back to Clyde in Jefferson, Clyde had asked about taking his balanced mutual funds, which are at Vanguard, Wellington, and breaking out the stock portion versus the bond portion. So Clyde, I would tell you that, first of all, Wellington it's always been one of the funds that I've always liked. Actively managed fund at Vanguard. Still pretty low cost, actually really low cost, and it's done a good job. However, when you're in retirement, though, when you are in retirement, I think that it does make sense to have individual companies so that you know exactly what income you're getting. Number one, number two, so that you can rebalance those companies at any given time, whether at times you're taking profits or if you're being able to control your tax situation. I also think individual bonds can be good too. They're trickier and you've got to be really, really careful with that, but individual bonds can play a role too. The reason I would say yes, break the two out. So Clyde's question is, hey, I've got bonds here and stocks all in one fund. Should I take them out and separately have them? And my answer, Clyde, is yes, I think that's fine to do. I like you to have better control of your income. However, you also have to recognize that where you are today with Wellington, it's also a pretty good way to do it too. So I think you almost would be fine either way. I just have a preference towards being able to control the income a little bit better. Does that make sense? And is that fund, by the way, is it in an IRA or a regular after-tax account, Clyde?
It's actually in two. It's been an old friend. I got into it when I was 30. And I've kept it around because, you know, I didn't understand bonds very well at the time. It's in my 401k, and it is also in an after-tax, just a brokerage account.
Right, and I think where you get more, you almost get more advantage to do it and break them out separately would be in your after-tax money. Remember, in an IRA, things are a little bit easier. 401k IRA, you don't have to worry as much about buying or selling or what the income looks like because it's real simple. Everything you take out of the IRA gets just taxed at ordinary income. On the non-IRA side, though, so if you think about where Wellington is for you outside of an IRA, I would say that's where you'd want to take a look at breaking the two out. So I'm a believer in individual stock, so I know the dividend I'm getting at any given quarter. Individual bonds or even your own bond ETFs that kind of have target maturity, so you know exactly what those durations look like. You don't want a bunch of long-term bonds right now with rates this low as interest rates rise over, call it, the next 5 to 10 years, and take control of your income. And then in the IRA or 401k, maybe leave that piece of the equation still with Wellington. Clyde, enjoy the rest of this wonderful day. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
More Money Matters, straight ahead. Up and down the hall, around the bed in our room. Well, here we go. Welcome back to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. Night after George Strait, packed out Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Pretty phenomenal. So good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. A little George Strait in the background here for the rest of the day. And we'll go to, and just during the break, we had a bunch of folks head into church. So I think we have time for at least one more call here on this Sunday morning. I was just talking to Tom from Suwannee over the break, asking about preferred stocks. What are preferred stocks? Like, what's the difference between stocks and bonds, and should you own preferreds? I'm going to get to that in just a second. So we have time for a call or two. If you are headed to church or brunch or anywhere around the city and you're in the car and you have a second and you have a question you've been thinking about, something's been eating at you, hey, maybe we should call Wes and Ryan on a Sunday morning at Money Matters. We're happy to do it here on a Sunday morning and help you out, set you in the right direction so you're not messing something big up financially, investment-wise, whether it's pension, lump sum, it's early retirement, it's a TRS or a 457 plan, you name it. We're here to try to help you through that and make better decisions. So give us a call. The number here in the studio, 404-872-0750, here on this chilly Sunday morning, again in the spring. 404-872-0750 is the number here in the studio. Phone lines are open. Or 1-800-WSB-TALK if you're outside of Georgia. Again, 1-800-WSB-TALK. And to answer Tom's question for Suwannee, what are these preferreds? And if you look at a preferred security and you know that you can now get 4.5%, 5.5%, 6.5% in interest, in yield, you start to say to yourself, interesting. That's good. 5.5%. Why wouldn't I want to own more of that? 6.5% yield. Why wouldn't I want to know more of that? So what are these preferreds? Well, preferreds are kind of this hybrid. They're not a traditional stock and they're not a traditional bond. They're really a hybrid security that lies somewhere kind of in the middle between the two. They're issued at a par value. So like a bond, they come out with a kind of par level value. And whether it's $25, it's $100, or $1,000, depending on how these things are issued, with an interest rate that is certainly above what companies, the same company would be paying on the bond side. Why? So you're compensated at a higher level. What's the trade-off? Well, the trade-off is that you're lower on what's called the capital structure. So if something happens, you get paid after the bondholders get paid. So something happens to the company, you get a liquidation, the bondholders get their money first before the preferred stockholders do. But you also get funds before common equity holders. So the question, what Tom was asking, hey, do I have to worry about the underlying stock? Does that impact the preferred stock? And the answer is not really at all. Because I think of the way a preferred stock trades a lot more like what a bond would do. So it's priced and moves with interest rates. Most of the preferreds that the general public owns, they own these $25 preferreds that have they don't mature, so they have ultra long time horizons. Think of them almost in perpetuity, or they last for 30 years, so it's almost like a 30-year bond. So they very much trade with interest rates. Interest rates go up, the preferred prices go down. That same inverse relationship that you see with bonds. Interest rates go down, preferred prices go up. So when the common stock, when does that part of it matter? Well, if something's really happening badly in the business, and if it's going out of business, that's when obviously you'll see a share price drop down to one or zero, and that means the company's going under, and that's when you'll see bond prices hit dramatically, preferred prices get hit dramatically. So you don't see a ton of movement for preferred prices when equity prices move, unless something really, really bad's happening to the company. And of course, both would get hit significantly. We're going to the phones here. Let's see. We're going to head to, again, number in the studio, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Shane from Lake Hartwell. What's going on, Shane? I love Lake Hartwell. How is it up there?
Oh, it was a beautiful sunset last night. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I appreciate your efforts. Two quick questions. One concerning Ford stock. It's a puzzling piece, in my opinion. Just it's lagging, and the dividend is quite compelling at the same time. I'd like to know your thoughts about that. But also, as a 43-year-old, should I be buying mutual funds or ETFs?
Well, I think the answer is probably all the above. The reality here is that the reason mutual funds have lost their luster, and you see these big mutual fund companies that are great mutual fund companies that are now half the size of what they used to be 20 years ago, it's not that mutual funds are bad. And mutual funds, I think, were a wonderful invention and a wonderful economic revolution that have helped millions of investors. Yes, there's been things that are bad about mutual funds, and they're not perfect with taxes, and they are known to have higher fees, but it was a wonderful invention to get a ton of diversification, and has helped, I would say, millions of Americans make a ton of money in stocks and bonds over time. It's a great vehicle. So it's not that mutual funds are bad, Shane. It's that ETFs are arguably just better. And it's almost as though we have had this evolution as we get better, faster, cheaper, and that's really what, and more efficient, less taxation. That's what the ETF revolution has done. And that's the reason you've seen a couple $1 trillion come out of mutual funds. That money hasn't disappeared. It's not uninvested. It's just gone into ETFs. And the companies that realized that 15, 20 years ago, those are the mutual fund companies that are also ETF companies that have also done really, really well. And they've been able to kind of hold market share and not decline. The mutual fund companies that just said, no, we're not doing ETFs. We just believe in we're sticking with mutual funds. And those are the companies, if you think from a financial perspective, those are the companies that have gotten cut in half. The companies that have not adopted or effectively have been stubborn against the revolution of ETFs, they're the ones that have been left behind. So for you as an individual investor, I'd say the answer is mutual funds good, ETFs better. And at 43, I think that because you have a long time horizon before retirement, you got 20 some years just to get to retirement, and then hopefully another 30 in. I think over time, ETFs are your answer. Individual stocks also are something to look at. But before you do that, I think you should wade into and start utilizing ETFs. That's my thought on this. Now, back to your other question. You called about Ford. You called about Ford stock, which has been kind of a disaster for a long time. Ford, if you go back into the year 2013, 2014, Ford was trading at 17, 18 bucks for a long time, and then has really just steadily declined ever since. Today, trading less than $9 a share. Dividend, though, is one of these enticing dividends. Well, hey, Ford pays 6.83%. Wow. Well, that's one of those dividend yields that's almost too good to be true. When you get into a dividend yield range in the 10% level, the 7% level, high sixes, low sevens, you have to start wondering what's going to happen. Are they going to be able to continue to pay that dividend? What's the cash flow look like? Ford hasn't really executed all that well. Now, it's pretty cheap on a relative earnings basis. It trades at below 10 times earnings. But the dividend yield is almost too good to be true at this point. And it wasn't long ago we did a show on how we pick dividend stocks. How do you screen for dividend companies? Well, I want to see a company that can raise the dividend. That means the underlying business has to be good. I want to see a company that has very low net debt. I want to see a company that has a positive free cash flow yield of over 4%. Can Ford check any of those boxes?
Yes.
The answer is no, they can't.
It just seems to me that, you know, they didn't take the bell out back in the day.
Well, there he goes. The government was listening. They didn't take the bailout back in the day. Click. Thank you for your call. The answer here is that Ford is one of those companies that just can't check any of those boxes. And if I want to own a dividend company or dividend paying company, I want them to. There's a lot of stocks to choose from. There are plenty of stocks you can find that have healthy balance sheets that do have a consistent earnings growth. And they can pay dividends, and I'm not worried about the dividend getting cut. I can't say that for Ford. So I'm personally, it's not something that I'm jumping up and down about. I would be really careful when it comes to a company like this. Now, I'm not saying that they can't find their way out of this. It's not to say they can't turn it around. But again, a little bit too risky for my blood. Now, let's go and talk about dividends for just a second, because we talked about, hey, it's a good company. Is it a good stock because it's paying close to 7%? What is the history look like on dividend paying companies? Well, the answer is it's pretty good. Now, a lot has to go right for a company to be able to continue to increase their dividends. Let's go back to the year 1972, and we're going to compare companies that were able to do just what I talked about, which is they either initiate and start paying a dividend, or once they start, they're able to grow it, even if it's 1 cent per year. So the dividend goes from 92 cents to 94, to 93 cents, 93 cents to 94 cents, just a slow, steady climb typically means something's going really well in that business. This is cash flow, profits that are paid out to shareholders. Actual cash flow that hits your investment account, hits your bank account 4 times a year. Dividend payments are just, they're cash. Dividends don't lie. So, you know, you can manipulate earnings. You can take one-time charges. Cash is cash. So you get a dividend, it's paid out by the company. The S&P 500 total return, regular normal market cap weighted, from 1972 to 2019 is up about 10.4% a year. You put in $100 back in 1972, it would be worth today about 10 grand, about $10,550. But if you looked at dividend growers and initiators, that is a group that has grown 12.77%. Dividend growers and initiators. Now, this is on an equal cap weighted basis. So you're getting a little help from some of the smaller companies in the S&P 500, still S&P 500, but in an equal weighting, 12.7% per year on average. So dividend growers, if $100, dividend growers and initiators grew to $28,000 over the last, call it almost 47, 48 years or so. So if you can find the companies that are doing this, and you can find the companies that have the ability to continue to ratchet up that dividend, it means there's a lot going right. And the market has rewarded those companies very, very clearly by the numbers. 10% for the S&P 500, almost 13% for an equal cap weighted version of dividend initiators and dividend growers. So again, hopefully that helps to answer your questions. You can find us throughout the week. You can go to, we've got a prize pack coming up. But if you want to find me and the Money Matters team, it's easy to do so. Just go to wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. We actually had a little bit of a website email issue for a little while there. That is fixed. So if you sent me an email and it didn't come through, or we didn't get back to you within 24 hours, it might have been an email glitch. That has been rectified and good to go. Those emails coming straight to me. So you can go to wesmoss.com, emails come straight to me and Ryan, and we're good to go. We'll get back to you within 24 or 48 hours. More Money Matters and a prize pack straight ahead. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Ryan Neal, we have a prize pack, man. What is it?
We do. The American Crawl Space Solutions Weekend Prize Pack is a pair of tickets to see Bryan Adams on Saturday, May 11th at Ameris Bank Amphitheater. Tickets are on sale now at livenation.com. Caller number 11. The tickets are yours.
I feel like every concert from now on is just going to be meh after George Strait, the king. Just everything after that, nothing will ever compare.
That is what you call a premium show.
It's a pinnacle. It's the pinnacle of all shows. I'm going to leave you with some pretty interesting market data. I'm going to go back to 1950 for a second. There are 19 observations, 19 times where we saw a January and then a February and then a March positive performance. So three in a row. positive month, positive month, positive month, January, February, March. That happened in 1950, 1954, 1963, 64, 67, and so on. Happened 19 times since 1950. And it just happened. Again, we were up, call it 7.9% in January of this year. We up 3% in February, and we were up a little over, call it a percent for March. It's happened it's happened 19 times. The question is, what did the market do for the rest of the year? Historically, what did the market do for the rest of the year? Interestingly, only one time. There's only one time when the March 31st through December 31st performance was negative, and that was in 1987. So every other time, 18 out of 19 times, the market did well, on average up 9.6%. So if you look at all 50 instances or all 19 instances since 1950, 18 out of 19 were net positive, and with an average rate of return of almost 10%. Again, this is just market history. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be the same here. But interesting to look back and see similar circumstances to help give us a little bit of insight into where we are perhaps headed. Good morning. Thank you for being with us here. Thank you for your calls, your questions. If you want to find me and the Money Matters team, Ryan, Ely, Wes Moss throughout the week, easy to do so. Just go to wesmoss.com. Those emails from the upper right-hand corner. Your questions, maybe they're more specific. We will get back to you throughout the week. Those emails come straight to me, Ryan and the Money Matters team. We're happy to help. Again, wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Stay tuned to the best programming on the planet. News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.